Hey friends, welcome back to another episode of The Bible Unmuted. I'm excited to be with you once again this week because we're going to be looking at a fantastic chapter from the Old Testament, namely Psalm 46. Now, you might be familiar with this psalm. You know the verse that says, "Be still and know that I am God." Well, that verse occurs here in Psalm 46. Now, this chapter has inspired music. It's been the focus of our prayers and contemplation and meditation through the years. I run to it often. I'm sure that you have as well. And so I thought it would be fun to dive into this text and study it in an in-depth sort of way here on the show. Specifically, we'll be looking at the Greek Old Testament version of this text. Most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the Hebrew Bible, mainly because that's what our modern-day English translations are based upon, which that's a great thing. I mean, we should be familiar, of course, with the Hebrew Bible. And, you know, as you know, the Old Testament was originally written in the Hebrew Bible or in the Hebrew language. Some of it was Aramaic, but most of it was Hebrew. And then over the years, though, it became important for the Jews to translate it into Greek. Some 200 or so years before Jesus was on the scene, a group of rabbis got together, Jewish leaders and scholars got together, and they translated it into Greek because Greek was the lingua franca of the day, the common language of the day. And so it made sense for their people to have their sacred scriptures in the language that they could understand. And it's important to know the Greek Old Testament, I think, because it gives us invaluable insights into the interpretive moves that these Jewish scholars made and how they interpreted and saw and understood their Hebrew Bible. Every translation, after all, is an interpretation. And so knowing our Greek Old Testament is important in this regard. It gives us invaluable insights into antiquity and the way the Jewish leaders understood their Bible. There's many other reasons, of course, for why we should study the Greek Old Testament. You know, it was the Bible of the early church, and early church fathers. This is what they used, and so it's just part of our shared tradition. And so I thought it would be fun to do this continual engagement with the Greek Old Testament here on the podcast. So we'll be diving into Psalm 46 now. I might mess up and say Psalm 45, and that's for good reason. So if you hear me say Psalm 45, it's not because I've lost my mind. It's because there's a versification difference. In the Greek Old Testament, you have Psalm 45. In our Hebrew Bible and English translations, it's going to be Psalm 46. So I'll try to keep it consistent, but if I go back and forth, now you know why. I'm still talking about the same passage of Scripture. Well, without further ado, let's jump into Psalm 46. And Psalm 45. I'll begin by reading the entire chapter, and I'll be reading from the second edition of the Lexham English Septuagint. For the end, a psalm in the name of the sons of Korah because of the hidden ways. Our God is a place of refuge and strength, a helper when afflictions find us very much. On account of this, we will not fear when the earth is troubled and the mountains are transferred in the hearts of the seas. Their waters roared and were stirred up. The mountains were troubled in his might. Musical interlude. The torrents of the river make cheerful the city of God. The Most High sanctified his habitation. God is in the middle of it. He will not be shaken. God will help it with his face. The nations were stirred up. Kingdoms fell. He gave his voice. The earth was afflicted. The Lord of powers is with us. The God of Jacob is our helper. Musical interlude. Come see the works of the Lord, which he set as wonders upon the earth, removing wars until the ends of the earth. He will crush bow and shatter weapon, and he will burn shields with fire. Cease from action and know that I am God. I will be lifted high among the nations. I will be lifted high in the earth. The Lord of powers is with us. The God of Jacob is our helper. All right, it's a fantastic passage again. Probably one of my favorite psalms, if I could be honest with you. It just speaks to me in so many cool ways. So, first thing we need to do is look at verse 1. We're just going to go verse by verse through this passage. Lots of interesting things to say. Now, the first thing that we need to point out is the very first verse is it contains a superscription. Okay, so this gives us some details about attribution, author attribution, and a few other details as well. So let me just reread verse 1 here. It says, "For the end, a psalm in the name of the sons of Korah because of the hidden ways." The sons of Korah, we're pretty familiar with them. The Korahites appear in the Old Testament in different places. Numbers 26 is a census, and it records that family is recorded there. First Chronicles 26, verse 1, they're described as gatekeepers. And in Second Chronicles, verse 20, verse 19, they're associated with praising the Lord, presumably instrumentally, musically. And so here, likely same group of people, and they're part, yeah, this, you know, this family, these, the sons of Korah, are associated with this actual text. So perhaps they wrote it. I mean, I think that's the common assumption. The interesting part that I do want to bring our attention to, though, is how the, you know, the first three words of this superscription, verse one, is "for the end." What is that? Eis ta telos. That's the Greek there. Eis ta telos. For the end. Telos is an interesting word because it can mean culmination, like a goal, some sort of final goal, if you will. And so you know, what does this mean? It seems pretty ambiguous, for the end. Well, okay, so you know, in the Hebrew Bible, you have to the leader. Like a musical leader, right? Here you have "for the end." So what's going on here? There's a great article that you can find. It's open source. On the public, you can just download it for free. It's an article called, pulling it out here, "Reading Psalm Superscriptions Through the Centuries." It's by Ian Valancourt. And it's an article written in 2023, published in Themelios is the name of the journal. Anyway, which is associated with the Gospel Coalition. So if you Google all of that, you'll be able to find it pretty easily. Anyway, it's an article on superscriptions in the Psalms. It's pretty insightful, pretty helpful. I recommend it to you. So I'll just kind of sum up the relevant portions here for us. But basically, this phrase "to the end," Valancourt, I think I'm saying his name right. It's spelled Valancourt. I'll just say Valancourt. Forgive me if I'm saying it wrong. But anyway, one thing Valancourt argues is, and talks about and discusses, is how this phrase "to the end" or "for the end," it was likely understood to be an eschatological phrase. So for the end times, you might say, okay? And, you know, in fact, in some of these psalms, he says, that are associated with David, this occurs here in the Greek Old Testament. And so the assumption is maybe this had to do with awaiting the Davidic Messiah. So anyway, I think this is really interesting because even the early church fathers, some of them interpreted this part of the Greek, of the passage "for the end," that phrase, they interpreted that eschatologically and specifically Christologically, that it was about Jesus, which I find pretty fascinating. And for those of you who may not be familiar with my own take on these things, of course, if you listen to the Roman series, you know that I'm in favor of a Christological interpretation of Scripture, not least because that's what Paul did, right? I mean, I showed that throughout the Roman series. And so early church fathers did this here. And arguably, this eis ta telos, this "for the end," was cast in eschatological terms, okay? So, how would you read Psalm 46 eschatologically? And once you have that as part of the context of the reading of the psalm takes on really more in-depth of a meaning, more deeper meaning, about the final events, judgment, recreation, the end of war, and all that kind of stuff. So I guess I just want to bring this out to say, as we work through this psalm, keep eschatology in mind, okay? Because arguably that's the tone that we have been given. That's the context in which this psalm has been received. So for the end, for the telos, the culmination of all things. And then it ends, but because of the hidden ways. What does that mean? I confess, I'm actually not sure. I mean, it probably has something to do with prophecy, with mystery associated with eschatology. So I'm willing to jump that, or I'm sorry, I'm willing to take that option. So for the end, a psalm in the name of the sons of Korah because of the hidden ways. So let's just start off by thinking about this psalm eschatologically. Okay. Of course, there are other ways to think about it, you know, personally, devotionally, you know, But keep in mind eschatology here, and specifically those final events with respect to judgment, the renewal of all things, the end of war, and those sorts of things, okay? So in verse 2, we have, our God is a place of refuge and strength, a helper when afflictions find us very much. So I really love how the Bible describes God as a helper. Ba'athos in Greek here. In Genesis 2:18, man is given a helper, the male, the man, he's given a helper in the woman. The woman is a helper. And, you know, a lot of times, I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, but anyway, I'll just say it again here. Sometimes we take this idea of helper as, you know, in the Genesis 2 passage, we take that as like an assistant. So man's assistant is his wife. And that creates this false idea that the wife is inferior to the man, right? And that's just not the case. That's just not what's going on here. The idea of being a helper in context, not least in Genesis 2, is the idea of, you know, a warring partner, right? Like it's a word that, it's a concept that conveys strength and might and power, okay, not inferiority. And it just drives me crazy. I hope I can be honest here. It drives me crazy when people interpret Genesis 2, and specifically the wife there, as being like this assistant, weak, inferior figure to Adam, the strong man, or something like that. That just drives me crazy because that's not the context. The idea of being a helper in the Hebrew Bible and here in the Greek Old Testament in this passage is one of might, which is why God himself is called a helper. And I think that's a very important piece that we cannot miss here. Helper is not assistant. Okay, so could you imagine? Our God is a place of refuge and strength, a weak assistant or an inferior assistant. No, he's a helper. Like he's a warrior. He's someone who helps us in strength. He is a fortress. He's a castle that we can run to. And I think this is something that's very important that we need to grasp is, friends, God is not our inferior. He is our mighty God and he helps us. And so I just wanted to say that about the idea of a helper. You also see this in Exodus 15, verse 2. The same word, ba'athos, is there for helper to describe God as such, ba'athos. So in the Hebrew Bible, I was just going to read from the New Revised Standard Version. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Same word help there is used in the Hebrew Bible, Genesis 2 as well. Okay, let's jump down to verse 3. On account of this, we will not fear when the earth is troubled and the mountains are transferred in the hearts of the seas. On account of what? Well, it's on account of the fact that God is our mighty warrior. He's our helper. He's the one who will do the fighting for us. He's someone we can lean on. On account of that, we're not going to be afraid. Okay, we're not going to be troubled when the mountains are transferred into the hearts of the sea. Now, what's being said here, I think, is a reference to tumultuous times, to what we might call thlipsis or tribulation. Thlipsis is the Greek word for tribulation. That's not what's being used here, but I think that's what it's anticipating, is that when Earth goes through times of trial, then we can lean on our God, who is our refuge. And speaking of tribulation, I mean, I have my view of tribulation, which, shameless plug, you need to go check out The End of the World as You Know It, because I talk about what tribulation means. I have a couple chapters that are relevant to that question. Short story here is I take tribulation to be specifically that time period of the church, right? So when Jesus ascends to the Father, Satan is out, you know, kicked out of heaven, and he wages war against the woman of Revelation 12 and against her offspring. And so we have that reality of tribulation. I mean, Jesus says, in the world you will have tribulation, thlipsis, John 16, verse 33. And we're not promised that that tribulation will be alleviated until he comes again to fix things. So when the earth is troubled, when it goes chaotic, we can trust in God. It's interesting that the language that's used here, the language of sea, the language of mountains being tossed into the hearts of the sea, this is really the equivalent of uncreation. So in the original creation story, for example, you have the sea being put in its boundaries, being pushed aside so that it can be tamed, as it were. And if this is an eschatological passage, as we said it is, then we can see how that what the psalmist is saying is that when the times get crazy, when the seas overtake us, when the seas transgress the boundaries that God has given them in the creation story, when that happens, then we can have peace still because God is our helper. And this is a very similar idea that you have in Revelation. Specifically chapter 7, chapter 14, you have these saints who are marked off with the seal of the Lamb to protect them against the judgments and the trials that will be happening, right? And I interpret that as any era of history. I don't take that necessarily as like a final events thing, but I do take it as eschatological because we live in the end times as we are now. Again, if you want more of my view on that, check out my book because they go in much more detail on all that stuff. Anyway, you get that here is that the earth will be going crazy. Chaos will be reigning. Chaos will be ensuing, but we can trust God in the meantime. We'll be protected. We'll be fine. That doesn't mean that we won't go through trials. That doesn't mean there won't be martyrdom, but it does mean that all will be well with our soul, that even when life goes crazy, we can trust God, and He's our stability. He's our helper. He'll see us through, even when the mountains, the high points of earth, are tossed in to the hearts of the sea. We can trust in God. And it goes on in verse 4, it says, "Their waters roared and were stirred up. The mountains were troubled in His might." Musical interlude. Okay, so the waters are roaring up. Again, this is that same idea of chaos. Genesis 1, the seas are tamed, pushed aside, given boundaries. But at times in human history, they are allowed to breach the boundaries because God withholds, for whatever reason, His grace, and the seas are allowed to bring destruction. So we see that, of course, in Genesis 6 and 7 and following with the flood narrative. The flood narrative is just the moment in human history where creation is being undone due to sin and evil in the world, right? Human and divine, human and supernatural, or you can say divine, or angelic sin, or the sins of those rebellious beings in the supernatural realm, and so forth. And so, anyway, so that's what he's talking about here, is that when you have these times of chaos, which, again, in the Hebrew Bible, in the Greek Old Testament, you have the waters as representing chaos. Okay, which that's going to be important later on. I'll refer back to Revelation because the waters appear in Revelation again as well. In fact, in the very next section, starting in verse 5, we have another scene of different types of water. And this scene of other types of water are actually presented as a good thing. Hey friends, thank you so much for listening to the Bible Unmuted. I hope you're enjoying today's episode. And as I've said many times before, my goal for the podcast is pretty simple. I want to give listeners the tools they need to interpret Scripture well. Thank you to everyone who prays for this ministry each and every week. If you find the podcast to be helpful and you think others might enjoy it too, consider leaving a review of the show on your favorite podcast platform and sharing with your friends. Also, if you're interested, consider becoming a patron of the show by visiting our Patreon page. This will give you access to some cool stuff, and it helps support the podcast. If you're interested, visit patreon.com/thebibleunmuted or follow the Patreon link in the description for this episode. Thanks so much for your support. All right, let's get back to today's discussion. This brings us to verse 5. It says, "The torrents of the river make cheerful the city of God. The Most High sanctified His habitation." Okay, the torrents of the river. What's up with that? So torrents here can be understood basically as like rapid motion of water. It's not like, okay, so in the New Revised Standard Version you have, "There's a river whose streams make glad the city of God." And that kind of gives off the feeling of calm waters, of like, you know, lightly sounding waters. But actually here, the idea is more of a rapid motion of a river, okay? The torrents of the river. I think that captures the idea. What's interesting about the river motif here is that it's often associated with the eschatological temple in the Old Testament. So, for example, you could read in Ezekiel chapter 47. We won't read it, but in verses 1 to 12, you have this river. It's like a life-giving river that's flowing out of the temple. And so let me just read, I will read this great little summary from the Faith Life Study Bible, which I highly recommend because it has a lot of good, nice little summaries in it. Anyway, I'll read the summary for Ezekiel 47, 1 to 12. It says, Ezekiel's temple tour concludes at the entrance of the temple proper, where he finds a stream of water coming from beneath the temple and flowing east. Ezekiel's guide walks him through the water, measuring the growing river and testing the depth until it becomes impassable just over a mile from the temple. The water flowing from the temple gives life and renews the land it flows through. If this holy district and sacred city represents Jerusalem, the life-giving power of the river would be significant in restoring the region east of Jerusalem, a dry, lifeless wilderness approaching the salty waters of the Dead Sea. Ezekiel seems to envision a river of life that heals the waters of the Dead Sea and turns the wilderness into a lush orchard. This imagery recalls the book of Isaiah, where the deserts bloom under Yahweh's redemptive hand. Again, that comes from the Faith Life Study Bible notes on Ezekiel 47. 1 to 12. So that really does capture what Ezekiel's talking about, is that you have this river that gives life. And I think that's what Psalm 46 is talking about. Now remember, Psalm 46 is an eschatological passage. These superscriptions, which Valancourt actually in his article mentions, you know, they were probably added later, but that does set the context nonetheless for us who have received the text. It's just part of the history of the text. And so it's meant to be taken in an eschatological context. Okay, and if all that's said, then what, if all that's true, which I think it is, then here what we have in Psalm 46 verse 5, or 45 verse 5, is that this idea of a river is the eschatological river, it's the temple river, okay? And and you have clues in the text itself. So it says, the torrents of the river make cheerful the city of God. So this river is in the city of God. It has something to do with the city of God, and it makes the city, and presumably its citizens, cheerful or happy, okay? And it says, the Most High sanctified his habitation. So this is a temple city. So 45 verse 5 here is definitely talking about the eschatological temple, which Ezekiel 47 talked about as well. Now, what's interesting is you once again get this in Revelation 21 and 22, this idea of a life-giving river. So, for example, in Revelation 21 verse 20, Revelation 21 verse 1, it says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more." Okay, so this is clearly the eschatological final event scene. It's when all things are made new. Notice that this body of water, this depiction here is of a sea that is no more. Now, this really bummed me out when I was a kid because, like, wait, so in the new heavens and new earth, there's not going to be an ocean? I love the beach, so what's up with this? Well, we have to understand the metaphorical value that this has here, okay? The point is to say that all evil, all chaos, all destruction will be taken away because you have to read this in light of the Jewish worldview. The seas were associated with the monsters of chaos. And that's why they had to be subdued, which is why they are subdued in Genesis 1. And when they are not subdued, when they breach their boundaries that God himself has given them, that is considered an act of judgment. So the powers of the dark forces, the dark realm, they're released upon the people in acts of judgment. The earth is caving in. It's imploding, you might say. The sea represents all that. And here in Revelation 21, by saying there will be no more sea, what it's saying is there will be no more evil. There will be no more chaos. Okay. So that body of water is done for. It's that type of water is out. It's not gonna be around in the eschatological city. But in Revelation chapter 22, you have, guess what? A river, an eschatological temple river. So in 22 verse 1, it says, "Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city." Okay, so here you clearly have a temple city. It's a place where God dwells, a place where God's people dwell. And there is a river. And this river is a life-giving river. Sounds a lot like Ezekiel. And if we have eschatological eyes to see it, it sounds a lot like Psalm 46, 45 verse 5 here. I think that's what's being discussed here. This is a temple city. It's a river. and it's the eschatological city. So now here's the thing. If we don't start reading the psalm with eschatology in mind, if we don't pay attention to that superscription where it says, for the end, the eis ta telos, for the end, if we don't pay attention to that, then we might not have the right context in which to interpret the text, right? So pay attention to these superscriptions because sometimes they're helpful. And here, definitely so. It will alert your eyes to these eschatological features that would go unnoticed otherwise. Okay, so we have the torrents of the river make cheerful the city of God, the Most High sanctified his habitation. That's a great thing that we can look forward to. It's certainly something the psalmist was looking for in the middle of his trials and tribulations, and we can do the same. Okay, then we're going to get to verse 6. Yeah, verse 6 is pretty fascinating. So here we have, I'll just go ahead and read verse 6. It says, God is in the middle of it. It will not be shaken. God will help it with his face. So God is in the middle of it. He's in the middle of the city. He's in the middle of his people. He will take care of them. The people, the city will not be shaken. Okay. Now later on, we'll notice in another verse down later, we'll notice, actually it's in the next verse, verse 7, it talks about the earth, it will be shaken. It will be afflicted. But there's something about the city of God that keeps it stable. And the thing about the city of God is that it's being indwelt by God himself, who cannot be shaken. He cannot be moved. He cannot be altered. He is the changeless one. And wherever he is, one can find heaven. There is stability where God is. And so if God is in the middle of it, that's where we want to be. And that's where Revelation takes us, is that that God will himself will make his dwelling place with humans. Okay, so we have that here. Now, what's interesting about this text, okay, is, and again, I'm using the Lexham English Septuagint, the second edition of that. It has, God will help it with his face. God will help it with his face. In other Greek manuscripts, that's not what you have. You actually have, God will help it in the morning or something to that effect. So there's a little bit of difference here between them in the manuscript tradition. And in the Hebrew Bible, and I'll just read from the New Revised Standard Version, you have, quote, God will help it when the morning dawns. So in the Lexham English Septuagint that I'm reading, you have God will help it with his face. In the Hebrew Bible, you have God will help it when the morning dawns. Okay, so what explains this discrepancy between the Hebrew and the Greek? And it's also a discrepancy, as I said, between Greek manuscripts. So depending on the manuscript that you're looking at, depends on what you're going to get. Now, the Lexham English Septuagint is based on Henry Barclay Sweet's critical edition of the Septuagint, or the Greek Bible, Greek Old Testament. I forget when it's published, but it's definitely an older, dated text. Okay, And so the manuscripts that he was working with had God will help it with his face, okay? And in Greek, that's to prosopo, okay, with face, okay? In other Greek manuscripts, you don't have to prosopo, you have ta pros proi. You see how they kind of sound similar? Ta pros proi. And you could translate that as in the morning or something like that. God will help it in the morning, ta pros proi. Now, so you have these two very similar sounding phrases, to prosopo and ta pros proi. And you can't help but wonder if maybe you found the source of your issue here. Maybe there was a scribal error based on some audible or not understanding or hearing it or something, or even seeing it, because they are largely similar. Now, in the Hebrew Bible, you have this, the word that's used here is, so let me go back to the translation, God will help it when the morning dawns. That's how the Hebrew Bible has it. God will help it when the morning dawns. Now, this word dawns actually is pana. It's the Hebrew word pana, and it means turns, or, you know, you can translate it as dawn. So when the morning pana, when the morning dawns or turns, okay? When the morning comes, when the morning faces you, it's this idea of turning in the sense of turning faceward, okay? Well, pana is the verb that's used here, but actually also it's important to know that in Hebrew, the noun is paneh, and paneh means face, okay? And so when it literally, you could say, God will help it when the morning faces, or when it shows its face. When the morning shows its face, you could interpret it like that. When the morning shows its face, God will help it. And so you have all these three different things going on, and you can kind of see where the discrepancy would come from. So if the original was Tal Pros Proi, which I assume that's actually what the original is. That's what the major critical edition of the Old Greek here in Psalms that I'm using, the Göttingen Septuagint. That's what I'm using. It's the major critical edition that scholars will use. They have in the morning, so Tal Pros Proi, and so it could be that there was just some sort of scribal error to get To Prosopo. In light of that. Now, what's interesting here, I'm not a text critic, so I haven't looked at all the secondary literature. I don't know what scholars are saying about, why there's this discrepancy or whatever. So that's just not my area. So I haven't spent a lot of time or any time really looking into the secondary literature, what scholars are saying and or whatnot. But what's interesting is the theology behind both of them are actually pretty interesting because, in the Hebrew Bible, you do have this idea that God, when God's face shines upon you, that good things happen. So I'm thinking of Numbers chapter 6, for example. Where it says, may God's face shine upon you. And this idea is an Aaronic blessing upon the people. Whenever God's face shines upon you, that's a good thing. And whenever God hides his face, which in the Psalms you get these prayers of like, do not hide your face from me, because that's the idea that, God has turned from you. And therefore, if you're not in the presence of God, in the face of God, you're not experiencing his blessing, right? So the manuscript tradition that has God will help it with his face, it works theologically. I mean, it makes sense, right? Though I do think that actually what's happening here is I think that the original is probably God will help it in the morning. And that's a motif that occurs a lot as well. Joy comes in the morning, for example. You might have heard of that in the Hebrew Bible. You might have read that. And that's definitely a common motif that in the morning God shows up and he rescues us and so forth. Anyway, that really gets us all into the weeds, but it's a great example of how you can have scribal errors based on similar the way the phrases sound very similar to one another. To prosopo, pretty similar to ta prosproi. And so maybe that's something going on there. Again, you have to go look at the secondary literature on what the text critics are saying about all this. I think it's fascinating. But just a cursory glance at this, looking over this, I think it makes sense as to why the original Hebrew, which has God will help it when the morning shows its face, and given when that's translated on into, as ta pros proi or something like that, it's easy to imagine how a scribe would take ta pros proi and translate it as to prosopo, speaking of God's face or something like that. But anyway, it's really fascinating, isn't it? So diving into these texts and looking into the weeds, it pays off because it's a lot of fun to look at the manuscript tradition and how it's been received through the years and some of the things that occur in light of scribal practices. Okay, I want to just move along, look at verse 7, where it says, the nations were stirred up, kingdoms fell, he gave his voice, the earth was afflicted. Okay, so the nations were stirred up. And in here, you have a very common idea that scholars are going to point out. It's like, okay, now the nations are participating in the chaos that the sea represents. So it's not only the seas, but it's the nations, okay? It's the nations who are in opposition to God and to God's people. Here in the Greek, it's ethne, which is sometimes translated as Gentiles, nations. You think of the English word ethnic, it's ethne, but here it's translated rightly as nations. They're stirred up like the chaotic waters. The kingdoms are falling, though. I mean, they're not able to stand up against God's ways and God's power. It says, he gave his voice and the earth was afflicted. Here, the word is shaken. Okay, It's the word that we encountered before where it says God is in the middle of the city, it will not be shaken. So here you have a juxtaposition between the city of God and, I guess, the city of man, to quote Augustine. So you have the city of God, the city of man, and they have two different ways of being. One is easily shaken, one can be shaken, one will never be shaken. And so the chaos waters, the nations that typify the chaos, they have a shelf life. They're not going to last forever. And as soon as God gives his voice, the earth will undergo a shaking, right? Interestingly, going back to Revelation, since we're thinking of this passage in terms of eschatology, going back to Revelation, you do have this Messiah in Revelation with a sword in his mouth. And that is portraying the Messiah, Jesus, as someone who has a very mighty, powerful word. And here you have that same motif. Okay, so what I'm trying to say here is that the Jews who wrote Psalm 46 and the Jews who read Psalm 46 were anticipating an end-time eschatological era where God would utter his voice, where God's voice would shake the nations. And really, that's what you see in the ministry of Jesus, the Messiah, who shows up, who is the Logos, the Word of God, who shows up and he shakes the world. He turns the world upside down. And that's exactly what the eschatological hope, and that's the eschatological expectation that early Jews had anticipated. And we see it here in Psalm 46. It goes on in verse 8, it says, "The Lord of powers is with us. The God of Jacob is our helper." Musical interlude. So I want to talk a little bit about the Lord of powers. In Greek, it's kurios ton dunameon. Literally, the Lord of the powers, or Lord of the powers. In Hebrew, it's going to be the Lord of hosts. And this concept is definitely not saying that, you know, we don't need to translate this as the Lord who is powerful, okay? That's not what kurios ton dunameon means. It's Lord of the powers, Lord of the host, the heavenly host, okay? It's not saying that the Lord is powerful. I mean, it is saying that, but it's saying much more. It's this heavenly host idea. It's a divine counsel idea. It's God as God over all the spiritual powers and forces that rule or seek to rule over the earth. He is the Lord over all things, over all sinister powers, not only over the nations, but over the monstrous chaotic seas, which are the products of the powers, okay? So you need to be thinking here of the divine counsel, the spiritual realm side of things, the forces of darkness and so forth. Here you have this musical interlude that I've been saying. In Hebrew, you have Selah. Here it's in Greek as diapsalma, and it's just translated as musical interlude. Not sure actually what it means. There's no consensus really, other than to say it's some sort of interjection or a pause, a meditative pause perhaps. So that's verses 5 all the way down to 8. Let's move on to verses 9, 10, 11, and 12. "Come see the works of the Lord, which he sets as wonders upon the earth." Okay, I want to talk a little bit about this idea of wonders. He sets wonders upon the earth. This is a terada in Greek. It's a common word in the Bible. And, sometimes, you've probably heard of signs and wonders. So God is like doing a work. I think that's the idea, that it's a work of judgment. It's a work of redemption. And again, we've talked about this before on the podcast, that the concept of judgment is not entirely negative. It's not, I mean, there is sometimes, unfortunately, a negative side to judgment, but judgment is just simply setting the world right again, making it fixed, fixing it, renewing it, making it whole again. And for those who have decided not to be on the side of the Lord of the powers, then they're going to experience the setting the world right again in a negative way. They're going to feel that as pain, right? Because, some people unfortunately do not want the world right again. They're pushing against the rightness of the world. And so when rightness has the final say, which it will, then the powers of darkness are gonna push against that. And so this idea of signs and wonders, this idea of God working miracles and powers and things like that, that's a very important motif because it's the beginning of his bringing change to the world. You see this often in the New Testament, for example, when not only Jesus, but the apostles and early Christians are doing miracles, performing signs and wonders. Paul talks about this. We saw in the closing chapter of Romans, where Paul says his ministry was associated with signs and wonders. It's this idea that, you know, it can invoke all sorts of things like healing. It can invoke other sorts of miraculous things, answers to prayer, that kind of thing. Just anything that manifests the power of God in that moment, those are signs and tokens of the eschatological kingdom. Okay, that's kind of foretaste, foreshadowing, pointing us toward the vindication that is to come, the redemption that is to come. Verse 10 says, removing wars until the ends of the earth, he, God, will crush bow and shatter weapon, and he will burn shields with fire. Okay, this is an important passage because it's definitely eschatological, right? So in other passages in the Old Testament, I'm thinking of Isaiah, and I believe it's Micah. Different passages talk about how God will destroy the weapons of war. He'll turn the weapons of war into agricultural tools, right? Here, you don't have that precise motif, but you have something very similar, obviously, that he's going to take weapons of war and destroy them. He's going to burn them up. And burning, of course, is another symbolic or metaphorical concept of judgment. So he's going to remove wars. And the best way to just see all this is to say that God's war is a war against war. That's what the eschaton is all about. God's war is a war that's against war. And one day, God will completely consummate his victory. In the meantime, we can rest assured that even though the earth is shaking, even though things are not looking too bright, even though we are experiencing a time of flipsis, this idea of tribulation, we can know that we can be of good cheer because after all, there's a river that makes glad, makes cheerful the city of God. Which we are. We are the people of God. We are the city of God, the temple of the Lord. And so even in the midst of these precursors of the eschaton, we can have hope. And interesting, you see God summon people to this hope in a sense. In verse 11, he says, cease from action and know that I am God. I will be lifted high among the nations. I will be lifted high in the earth. So this idea of ceasing from action, scalazzo, it's this idea of being at rest, being in a state of leisure even. And there's a couple things that God's doing here. I think one, he's summoning the nations to obedience. He's like, you know, come and know that I am God. I, not you, will be lifted high among the nations. I think there's this implicit assumption here that the nations need to be, it's an implicit command, imperative to bring the nations in to say, look, you need to worship me. I'm the true God. I'm the one who sets the world right again. Are you going to be on my team? Okay, I admit that part's there. There's an evangelistic component, no doubt. But actually, I think it's also a word of comfort to those who are in the city, to those who are Christians who find their home in the temple of God even now. He's saying, look, cease from action. Be still. Be at rest. Find leisure in the fact that I am God. I will be lifted up. This is definitely an eschatological piece. I will be lifted high among the nations. The nations are raging. The nations are doing this. They're the watery chaos, but I will be lifted high in the end. I will be lifted high in the earth. So I take this verse 11 to be a word of comfort to those who are experiencing the plight of tribulation, those who might be in despair, those who might be troubled and whatnot. This is a summons to rest. And I love the way the New Revised Standard Version and most versions translate the Hebrew here is be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am God. And I think this is a very important piece here that we need to remember as we spend our days in between the first and second comings of Christ. The chapter ends at verse 12. The Lord of powers is with us. The God of Jacob is our helper. Again, the Lord of powers is not saying the powerful Lord, but rather the Lord who is Lord over the powers. Kurios ton dunameon. the Lord of powers, the Lord of hosts in Hebrew. He is the one who is with us. This idea of being with us is again the idea that we see in Revelation 21 and 22, where God is with his people. And where he is, things will not be shaken. Where he is, that is heaven. That is the place of heaven. And where he is, that is where his people will be. And even now, we do not have to wait for the final event, the eschaton, to experience the presence of God. The whole biblical story is how God is wanting to be with his people in the real world right now, which is what Pentecost is all about. Pentecost is about that moment where the church becomes the church, where the people become indwelt by the glory of God, the Holy Spirit, the same Spirit that dwelt in the innermost holy place of the temple has come to dwell in the hearts of you and I. As we trust in Jesus, he is with us, and he's with us. This is the seal of the Lamb spoken about, I think, in Revelation 7 and Revelation 14, the seal of the Holy Spirit that's spoken about in Paul's letters. So this is that idea that we are made temples of the living God. And I think that's what Psalm 46 is anticipating. Psalm 46 is meant to get the Jewish mind upon the Jewish hope, namely the end when God makes all things right again. So this has been a fascinating time to look through this text. I think spending time in Psalm 46 is well worth it, especially when you take the superscription seriously, for the end, you know, for eschatology, you might say. I think that's very appropriate to see in this text. Well, friends, that's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. I pray that everything that we discussed today here on the podcast has been helpful to you. I encourage you to go back and read Psalm 46 and dive into the text again, pray through it, sing about it, sing with it, and most importantly, hope. Gain hope from this text as we look forward to the day when God makes all things new. That's the end of today's episode, and thanks again for listening to The Bible Unmuted. If you like this podcast, consider rating it on your podcast platform, subscribing, and sharing with your friends. You can also support the podcast by becoming a Patreon member. Go to patreon.com/thebibleunmuted or simply find the link to the Patreon page in the description for this episode. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, friends.